The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome back to the Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. Now, a hotter world will hit some countries harder than others. Southeast Asia's largest nation, Indonesia, might just be one of them. Jakarta is already the world's fastest sinking city. And as the impacts of climate change become clearer, food supply, clean water, the incidence of disease and displacement will be very real scenarios for ordinary Indonesians. Yet critics say the Indonesian government has not been sufficiently ambitious in its commitments to cut carbon emissions. What accounts for this and what can realistically change? With me to discuss this is Dino Pati Jalal. Dino is a founder and chairman of the think tank Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia, or FPCI, and an Asia Fellow at the Milken Institute Asia Center. He's also a former Indonesian Deputy Foreign Minister and former ambassador to the United States. He's based in Jakarta, where he's calling in from. Dino, welcome.
Hi, Jamie. Good to be here.
Thanks. Now, I'm going to start our conversation sort of big picture, and I want you to talk a little bit about Indonesia's net zero emissions targets. The timeline set is 2070. What's your take about the timeline? What were the considerations behind setting that as the target, 2070, instead of, you know, a lot of people saying 2050?
We don't like that target at all. In fact, we convene the Indonesia Net Zero Summit 2 months ago, and everyone, all the NGOs and activists and think tanks from environment and climate issues that were present, all of them said that 2070 is really conservative and not helpful at all to Indonesia and to global climate challenge. We are calling for net zero 2050, because we believe that the house will start burning by 2050. The carbon stock that we have to keep the global temperature below 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's only until 2050. And after that, if we don't do the right things, then things will go way up, even reaching to 4 degree temperature rise. For the government to say 2070, that's way too late. And I think it's because they really haven't gotten their mind into this. It's still a very much a sectoral issue to the Department of Environment. And the policy will begin to move away from 2070 to more progressive targets.
Do you think regular Indonesians understand the implications behind 2070 target and what actually needs to be done in addition for the Indonesian economy for it to get to 2050 as the net zero target? What are the implications?
First, I don't think the public gets it yet.
Yep.
Because everyone is in the COVID-19 mindset. So everything is about COVID-19.
Yeah.
We're saying COVID-19 is going to be over in 2 or 3 years, right? It's a short-term crisis. But the longer-term one is the climate crisis. And the public doesn't really understand when we say it's 3 degrees hotter, they will say, okay, so what if it's 3 degrees hotter? They don't understand that will mean a boiling weather. India had heat wave that reached 123 degrees. Can you imagine? You can't walk outside. You can't even breathe outside in that kind of weather, right? You can't play soccer. You can't ride your bike and so on, right? And that's going to be the new normal if things become 4 degree temperature rise by 2050, right? The good thing is we just launched a campaign for net zero world, including Indonesian celebrities. You know, these are celebrities with a combined followers of 50 million people. It would take a lot of efforts and sustained efforts to awaken public opinion. But definitely what the public don't get yet and what the business and government still do not get yet is that if you move to low carbon economy, you actually make more money. You create more jobs, you attract more investments, you get more technology, you get more equity, and so on, right? Getting them to understand that new paradigm is important, because still the thinking now is that, look, if we move to more renewables and more green economy and so on, then we lose money. It's just too much work, you know, and the economy is just not ready for that huge overhaul, right?
Yeah.
People to accept that new paradigm is, and the business to accept new paradigm is a huge challenge for us, though.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that because, again, this is a recurrent theme in my conversation in other episodes of this podcast about sort of painting the opportunities out there in terms of the green transition. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to talk to you then about the overall structure of the Indonesian economy. Mm-hmm. As it stands now, so much of your power, for example, comes from coal. Mm-hmm. You do export a large amount of coal as well. How do you foresee Indonesia sort of transitioning away from one of these most polluting fossil fuels in coal and making, therefore, as you say, the argument that the alternatives actually are out there for all of us, Indonesia included, to sort of grasp?
This is why this is an economic issue, but also a political one, Jamie.
Yep.
Right now, a majority of our emission is coming from a forest, land use and a peatland. Yeah. But energy in the coming years will overtake those sectors to become the largest source of emissions, energy and transportation. And for our energy, the Jokowi government has really increased our electricity supply, 35,000 megawatt, yeah, that has been the target of the Jokowi government since 2014. And much of it is from coal. So the biggest question is, look, if you are committed to climate economy, how do you square that with the coal energy,
yes,
which is predominating our energy system? So they need to phase out for sure. So far, the plan hasn't worked that well because the target for renewable energy, which is 23% by 2025, is far from being achieved. Right now, we're about 10% out of the 25%, and we got about three more years left. So things are not going according to schedule in terms of renewable. And phasing out coal is going to be a challenge because the government built all this electricity supply, but there's a lot of access because the industry is not using as much as it was predicted. So they got all this access, they spent all this money, and they see this as a cost-benefit thing, right? So phasing out coal will be a challenge, and especially because, you know, the coal industry is politically important as well. You know, they support political players, they support political parties, and so on, right?
Yeah.
The biggest challenge by far is how do you phase out coal in Indonesia's energy system, especially since it's not just economic or energy issue, it's also a political issue. But I believe we haven't done enough to engage the coal people in this discussion. You know, we're just assuming the coal people doesn't want to cooperate. But let's try them out, you know, raise the issue with them. They got kids,
yeah,
who are climate conscious, mm-hmm, right? They got kids who will grow up in a hot world environment. So I'm sure if they know the situation and we ask them, what's your solution will be, I'm sure we're going to hear some interesting responses.
I actually listened very carefully. I noted your references to it being a political issue in Indonesia, this transition. And one of the more sensitive political issues obviously also relates to things like fossil fuel subsidies, right?
Yeah.
It is deeply political, not just in Indonesia, in most other developing countries as well. And it's something that this government has had to deal with, previous governments as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe for the listeners, give an idea as to the depths and the sort of nuances in the Indonesian political system as to how far things like fossil fuel subsidies, coal, how does it impact the common man and therefore their perception of where energy lies, how cheap energy should be? Because this, I think, will have an impact on how much people are willing to pay for energy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have the numbers in my head, but definitely President Jokowi has reduced fuel subsidies, but it's still there. The price is not as competitive as it should be. And what should be done, in fact, is how do we make renewables cheaper than fossil fuel? There are incentives or even subsidies to be given. It should not be to fossil fuel industry, but should be given to geothermal, solar, hydro, and so on. The government is yet to do that, right? One of the big scenes in the future would be the electric vehicles, mm-hmm, right? Because a lot of nickels and Indonesia wants to be a hub for the production of batteries, right? For cars and so on, you know, electric batteries.
Yep.
That's going to be, I think, the big future for Indonesia. And a lot of businesses are gearing up for that. You need to give a lot of incentives and even subsidies for non-fossil fuel development in Indonesia, right? I have friends who are in solar.
Yeah.
And they want to do solar, but they're not going to make too much money doing that. And one area is solar for residential homes. There isn't really any company that can do this on a massive scale. That would be required if we want to get this thing under control, right? There's a lot of policy developments that can be initiated by government, especially to boost renewables and to reduce fossil fuel use in Indonesia.
Yeah. Talking about renewable energy, I mean, a lot of people would have at the top of their mind when they think about a huge country like Indonesia. I mean, you're basically an archipelago. You basically have resources, you have renewables, but you're such a large country. What are the technical financial implications of making renewables more mainstream? It's one thing to say, let's try this in small cities, but it's another thing to be able to export this and to make it viable for the huge expanse that is your country, isn't it?
On financing, the industry has said that the amount needed is huge and the money simply just isn't there.
Yeah.
For example, to transform our energy system to renewables, the projection is it would cost $20 to $25 billion per year between now until 2030. So that's a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
A lot of our money now is being used for COVID recovery, right? And not for these things.
Yeah.
But even without COVID, getting $20, $25 billion a year is just going to be very difficult. Internationally, the COP process, the UN COP process, has aimed to get $100 billion of financing for mitigation and adaptation. And even that amount is still very difficult to be reached internationally. And that's only $100 billion of climate financing. I'm not talking about trillions of dollars. So the money part is a challenge. And obviously, there's a lot more money in the private sector for green financing. For some reason, Indonesians have not been able to attract them. And there's a lot of complaint about the carbon credit. The players that I talked to, they say, hey, you know, we're not getting much money. When we do the right thing and when we preserve the forest and I want to get carbon credit for it, the price is too low and the process is too complicated and too long. That explains why it's just not a happy story so far. Businesses are not attracted to renewables in the way that they should. Right? The potential is very underdeveloped, right? So, for example, I got some stats in front of me. For Indonesia, solar, it's only 0.07% that is realized out of 107 gigawatt. That's very low number. For wind, there's only 0.25% realized out of 60 gigawatt. Right? On geothermal, it's relatively better than others. It's almost 9% realized out of 23 gigawatt. But the point is, across the board on renewables, the realization of the potential is very minimal, less than 10%. In many cases, less than 1%.
Well, the thing is this, I mean, from the picture that you paint, yes, obviously, it would appear that lots of work needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the potential that we see in Indonesia, whether it is in things like renewables, whether it's in even like how it helps develop a carbon credit trading system. Mm-hmm. There's so much potential out there. I mean, it's just waiting to happen, right?
Yeah.
And on the issue of fossil fuel subsidies, I also wanted your take on the flip side of a subsidy, and that is the carbon tax. Mm-hmm. We see places, I mean, obviously in Singapore, we've put that in place. Is it something that you think, with all that we've discussed so far, is something viable that the players in Indonesia think is something that could be politically acceptable one fine day where people talk about carbon tax?
I think so. Our finance minister, Sri Mulyani, has been talking about that, or at least responding to that. And a lot of NGOs, including FPCI, my organization, is calling for a carbon tax. What needs to happen before that is an uptick in public opinion, Jamie.
Yeah.
The government doesn't respond well to think tanks and activists, but they respond very well to public opinion, right? Especially the youth and the millennials, right?
Exactly.
So in the run-up to COP26 in Glasgow, we're going to see interesting developments in politics, in business and technology, and in diplomacy. Paris Treaty was really not about countries coming out with targets, right? Because in Paris, the technology, the politics, and the diplomacy was not really ripe yet. we were able to set the 1.5 degree emission limit as a target. But we would wait until this COP26 in Glasgow, after 5 years being reviewed, that countries would be expected to come up with more concrete and more ambitious numbers, right? That's what we're beginning to see now. More and more countries are announcing net zero. I think the number is, if I'm not mistaken, 2/3 of countries. But more countries have announced the net zero target, and politically it's becoming the politically correct thing to do. The businesses are getting onto this. Last year, more than 1,000 MNCs signed on to more science-based climate targets, and so on and so on. We're going to see a lot of interesting developments this year, and especially because technology also, we expect to see, just like cell phones, right? Cell phone used to be big and heavy and costly, and now, it's cheap as hell, right?
Yeah.
So electric cars and a lot of the solar technology and all that is going to be much more cheaper and much more accessible.
I'm glad you raised COP26, the UN FCCC's Conference of Parties meeting in Glasgow, because as we close off our conversation, I'm going to tap on your experience as a career diplomat as well in explaining sort of the evolution of Indonesia's role in international environment and climate negotiations, and whether you think Indonesia, as such a huge and influential country, has a role to play in nudging and showing movement to other countries, helping close the gaps, for example, between the US and China, and playing a role in various sort of smaller sub-forums leading up to the COP26. But explain first Indonesia's role and how you think it's changing.
Definitely, Indonesia has a role, first because we are one of the largest emitters in the world. I think we're in the top 10. We hosted the COP13 in Bali before, where we produced the Bali climate roadmap. And one thing that we're proud of, we were the game changer, Jamie, in the run-up to one important COP meeting. I think it was in Copenhagen, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Indonesia was the first to break ranks with the developing countries to announce the 26% reduction. At the time, that was a taboo thing to do because the developing countries were saying to the developed countries, you go first, you announce your targets, and we don't want to do that, because this is your responsibility, right? And it was hard to break ranks, but we thought the right thing to do was break ranks, and we did. We announced a target, a very clear target, 26%. And after that, it was followed by other developing countries, right? And that changed the game. But now that's no longer enough. The game has shifted, and Indonesia definitely needs to develop higher emission targets. We are calling for 50% reduction by 2030 compared to business as usual scenario. Yeah.
Yep.
Indonesia still has time to demonstrate that everybody needs to be ambitious in their net zero target. But we need to prove that we can set a target of 2050 first. Otherwise, we don't have much credibility to do so. And, especially Indonesian ministers such as Erlangga and Sri Mulyani are going to be playing an important role in the run-up to the COP26 in various capacities as co-chairs of some committees, I forget the name of the committees, and so on. So Indonesia does have a role to play, and especially on matters relating to carbon sink, because we have proved as a positive note that we have been able to reduce deforestation significantly in the last 3 years.
Yes.
Right. I think the number is 85% deforestation reduction. On that, we're doing better than Brazil, right? And some other countries. I think in Brazil, deforestation is grown quite worse in recent years. But still, we need to announce the net zero 2050 target to play a credible role up there.
Well, everyone here in the region, obviously, as well, is hoping for Indonesia to succeed and do better and better, for example, as you say, on issues such as deforestation. As a final question, then, as you look forward to COP26 as a sort of an outside observer, mm-hmm. obviously watching it very closely, what are you hoping that, the big countries are going to be able to do, yours included, but as well as, China, because so many people are looking to China to sort of set the stage for developing countries. Countries taking much more ambitious targets. But do you think more needs to be done in areas like financing as well?
I think so. I mean, the good news is the G4, if we can call it that, which is the US, China, Japan, and Europe have agreed to very ambitious climate reduction targets. And these four are really a big chunk of the global emission, right? So that's the good news. The bad news, of course, is that them four alone is not enough. You need everybody to get on board. And I hope that, you know, they will be able to cooperate. I mean, it's geopolitically important for U.S. and China to cooperate on climate change, right? At least one area where they can cooperate.
Yes.
If they don't do that, then it will be very sad, right? But also for them to push developing countries and provide the finance and technology, that will be important achievement for COP26. A lot of developing countries want to do the right thing, but the money isn't there. A lot of them have moved their positions, and if they can't even agree to set the $100 billion target by COP26 in Glasgow, you know, it's going to be a bad signal because it just doesn't add up to the rhetorics of, hey, this is our global problem, our common problem. We got to tackle this together and so on. So they got to convince the developing countries also that this is going to be a new chapter where everybody will work together and there'll be a lot more resources available for everybody.
Dino Patijalal, on that note, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jamie. And good luck and stay safe.
And thanks for listening to Climate Conversations. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on CNA.Asia. It's all on the orange tab. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Erin Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.